Well, greetings from the somewhat cooler areas of Kansas, farther north of here. Although, tomorrow, I think we're supposed to have extremely warm weather in Kansas and maybe warmer than you have here. So we had an unusually warm and early spring. So my wife is here with me today as well, Karen, and our three children. Kirza is 11. She's sitting with her cousins, as is Xenia, who is 9. And you'll probably be hearing some from Kavian. He's only 2.5, so he'll probably be trying to talk about the same time I am. I'll try to drown him out, though. So the question that kind of has shaped this series of talks is the question of Islam and Christianity. How did we get to the point we are now? How did we get to this point where tensions are so high between these two religions? Now, I assume that most of you who are old enough to remember the 9/11 attacks kind of asked this question at some point as well, although you probably phrased it more as, how did Islam get to be such an antagonist of America? But for many Americans, that's not the way they would phrase it. They would phrase it more, how did they become such a serious antagonist of Christianity? Well, I'm an Anabaptist. I have a little different way of answering that question than many Protestant-minded historians, although we're going to agree on quite a bit. So, some time ago, I'm guessing the children were, Kirza and Xenia were probably, 3 and 5 is my guess. And like children do, they got in a squabble. And Xenia, the youngest, and she may have been 3 or 4, I'm not sure how old she was, she came to Karen and she had a simple request. Mama, I need some medicine because I'm having a troubled time with Kirza. Now, she had a solution. It was a simple solution. It was also simplistic, I would say. Wouldn't it be nice to just have a pill that you take and that fixes all your interpersonal relationship drama? Well, I think a lot of people have looked at the problem at Islam and Christianity and said, surely there's a simple solution. And I think a lot of simplistic solutions have been put forward. I propose that the solution is a simple one, not a simplistic one, but it's a hard one. It's simple and hard, and it involves life change that we're not usually willing to make because it's very painful. So we're going to get more into that on Sunday with a wrap-up. What I'm attempting to do for the first 5 talks, so that's tonight, and that's tomorrow night, and the first talk on Sunday, is just kind of lay out the story of the relationships, how relationships between the two religions have gone over time. So that means we're going to have to look at where we've come from and see the things that have happened so we know how we got to where we are now. And then I do intend to propose a solution on Sunday. And I think it will be one that you guys recognize and probably will agree with. I'm going to start, I want to tell the story of Islam and Christianity in 5 stories. Now, obviously, historians can't tell a simple story. We always make it more complex. And for the record, I'm not a historian. I'm a history teacher. I have done very little actual writing and research in the historical discipline, a little bit in college. But I have read quite a few historians' works. And so I am coming to you as a teacher, not really as a professional historian. But I'm relying heavily on the historical discipline, the people who do it for a living. That brings me into another little caveat I have, and that is, as I think about what stories to tell, I'm going to have done some editing of history. And as I tell the stories, I'm going to have to edit it even further. So obviously, I come with my biases. I could be wrong on some things. My guess is, though, that most of the stories I have picked out would be picked out by most historians. I might give them a different interpretive twist, but I think I'm more or less operating in sync with the historical discipline. So we're going to start our look at how the two religions get to the point of tension where they are today. We're going to start with this guy. His name is Constantine the Great. Now, you might instantly wonder, if you're telling the story of how things start, why not start with the founders of the religion? Well, I will be telling the story of Muhammad next. He is the founder of Islam. I chose not to start with Jesus because I couldn't find any compelling reason to see that Jesus was part of the problem. I don't think Jesus has created any of the tension that exists currently between the religion, except on one point. He said he was God. In that way, he did. But I think the real tensions, the real troubles start with Constantine the Great. So I do have a timeline over here. I discovered it was actually kind of hard to see it sitting in the back there. So if you can't understand it or see it, that's okay. It's just supposed to be a visual representation of when the different stories happen. So you kind of have a sense for the progression of history, how the story moves. So Constantine is going to be our first guy that we talk about because he actually is the first, chronologically speaking, he's also the first. So Constantine the Great comes along, and I'm going to use the convenient number 312, and you'll find out more why I use that number. So 312 years after Jesus was born, according to this timeline that we use, is when Constantine the Great has a big moment where he comes on the world scene. So that gives you a bit of a sense for the time we're talking about. However, I'd like to start by backing up substantially from there and take a quick look at the world. It's a little harder to see up there than I was expecting it to be. This is the world of Jesus' day. So there are just a couple things I want to highlight on here. Number one is, if you looked at the world in Jesus' day, there are kind of three major centers of civilization. You've got over here in the West, you have the Roman Empire, and then the next empire is the Persian Empire, and then the Chinese Empire over here. Now, if you'll note, this is going to be kind of important. The land up here, just north of them, is going to be occupied mostly by nomadic peoples that ride horses, and they don't really settle down in cities like the civilizations below them. So the word civilization has the idea of city dwelling. It comes from a Latin word civitas. So that's what's going on in the first century. You've got these three different kind of settled societies across Asia. Now, admittedly, there is civilization going on down here in the Indian subcontinent. I just forgot to include it earlier, and it doesn't really enter in our story very much. I guess the Chinese Empire is not going to enter into it a lot either. Okay, let's keep going. So this is the Roman world. So this would be the Roman world of about 100 years after Jesus' death. And this is the greatest extent of the Roman world. You can see it's kind of built around the Mediterranean Sea, and it ends up conquering the rimlands of the Mediterranean Sea and being pretty satisfied with that. Now, a couple things happen very quickly after... let me back up a bit. So Jesus is born, he dies, and comes back to life and goes to heaven. And that all happens in the first century. Now, fast forward into the middle of the third century. So this is, you'll see the numbers here. This is in the 200s. In the 200s, something bad starts to happen to Roman society. They become just incredibly badly governed. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that. I can't go into any of them. We're going to move right along. We have to go really fast with a bunch of this stuff. Just note that between 235 and 284, the empire ends up splitting at times during that period into three different empires. So you had the one empire based over here in the east around Palmyra. Another empire was here in the center, and that's more based on Rome. And then in the west, you have another empire, and this would be more a Gaulish empire. So these empires ended up with competing emperors, and there was a lot of dead emperors, a lot of stabbed emperors. In fact, I think something like 22 different emperors during this time frame, and maybe as many as four of them died of natural causes. The rest were murdered. So this is not a happy time for the empire. It's called the crisis of the third century. At the same time that this is going on, a plague sweeps through the empire. It's called the Cyprian Plague, maybe around 250. We're not sure if it's smallpox or measles, but lots of people die during this plague. It feels to the Romans that their world is in crisis. Now, the Romans have been worshiping pagan gods, and they think it's a little strange that the Jews, and of course now the Christians, claim there's only one. But they don't really care all that much about it. As long as you offer a pinch of incense to the emperor and pray to him, then you can go about your duties, pay your taxes, and you'll be fine. Well, of course, the Christians find this difficult, so we're going to get into that in a little bit. But before we do, let's note that this crisis of the third century that we're seeing here does get resolved. It gets resolved by a man by the name of Diocletian. Now, Diocletian comes along and he says, okay, we've got to stop this killing emperor stuff, and we've got to start being more rigorous in our governing. So we're going to organize better. He was a very skillful general, and he used his military prowess to fight his way to the top and then to impose an iron discipline on the empire. What he really does is grabs the empire by the nape of the neck and shakes it until it obeys him. So he has a long reign, and what he does during his reign is he says, we're going to completely redo the empire. We're going to have two emperors. We're going to have one emperor based over here in the eastern part, and we're going to have another emperor based over here in the western part. And those two emperors will each have an assistant. So if you'll see these names up here, I'm not going to get into them. Just know that the emperors were called the Augustuses or the Augusti, and the assistant emperors were called Caesars. And this is called the Tetrarchy. So Diocletian sets up this government, and he says, after 20 years, you're going to resign, and then the assistant emperors will step up and reign for you. Okay, so that's what he does. Of course, he resigns. Now, you should say, no, not of course. Very few Roman emperors resign, but he does. He's one of the unusual Roman emperors to resign. And he says, okay, Caesars, you guys step up now. And that kind of worked, but as soon as one guy stepped up and there was somebody in the wings saying, I wish that was me, and boom, we have a civil war almost immediately. So, Diocletian is in retirement, there's a civil war going on, and that sets up some of the chaos that's going to make it possible for this Constantine the Great guy to come along. But before we get to that, we need to back up and tell something that happened at the end of Diocletian's reign, so that we understand the full import of Constantine. So, somewhere around 303, Diocletian decides that it's time to get rid of this sect of Christians. And the reason he does is he wants to organize religion just as he has organized all other aspects of the empire. So he's done some really interesting economic reform that actually did not work at all, but he tried to set prices throughout the empire for every single thing. He's trying to bring rational government to all aspects. So why not do it to religion? So he takes the Roman worship of the pantheon of gods they worship, Jupiter, and so on, all those others, and he decides he's going to be Jupiter in the flesh, and everybody has to worship him. I'm Jupiter, now you worship me, I'm a god. You don't want to not worship a god because they can do terrible things to you. And he does it like he does everything else. And so he starts sending out his guys to tax people, and when you pay your tax, you also offer a pinch of incense to Jupiter, and you pray to him, and you pay your tax, and then you're given a receipt. Now, if you don't have that receipt, and you get caught without a receipt, you get in trouble. And of course, the Christians are saying here, we can't worship Caesar. So the Christians end up getting this very vicious persecution directed at them in an attempt by Diocletian to bring rational government to all things, including religion. Okay, so this is going on right at the turn of the century, right around 300, a little afterwards. It doesn't last particularly long, but in some parts, it does last until about 312. After Diocletian resigns and this quick little civil war begins, what's going on is over in Britain, the Constantius, who is the Caesar in Britain, has a son named Constantine. And Constantius dies before he can take his office as Augustus. And so the legions in Britain say, well, let's make Constantine in his place. Let's make him the Augustus. And of course, the other emperors, would-be emperors, said, no, we don't like that idea. And so there is a kind of a mad scramble for who's going to be the Augustus here in Rome, in the West. Well, Constantine said, I know what to do. He grabs his army. He marches south. He crosses into Roman territory. And, of course, the other emperors get their armies, and they start marching toward him. And there's a place. There's a bridge across the river. It's called the Milvian Bridge. And there's a big battle to, you know, right around that place. I think Constantine had to cross the bridge and then fight them, or it might have been the other way around. I don't remember exactly which side of the bridge they were on. But there was this big battle that took place there. And the legend has it, and I say the legend, Eusebius, who is a Christian, writes about this. So, but it has elements in it that don't sound right to most of us, or even to most historians. But the story goes, he sees in a vision the night before the battle, he sees this sign. It's called the Cairo, and it's the Greek letters that make up kind of an anagram that make up the name of Christ. And there's a voice that says, go and in this sign conquer. Conquer in the name of Christ? Why would this make any sense to a Roman emperor? Well, to understand that back here in Britain, the church was never persecuted as badly there. And Constantine's mother had been a Christian, or was a Christian, during most of this time. And so Constantine has this kind of family connection to Christianity. Well, he goes ahead and wins the battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312, and he becomes the emperor in the West. Later, he's going to become the emperor in the East as well. And when he does that, he's going to go down here and he's going to build up a little village called Byzantium into a great city. We're going to call this Constantinople. So for much of our story, we're going to keep coming back to Constantinople. Constantinople is a huge city, and of course, Constantine makes it very nice. He builds a brand new city here. This is where he's going to rule from, and he is ruling both halves of the empire. So he's kind of done away with Diocletian's tetrarchy. And now, he is back to ruling the entire empire by himself. Well, as you might expect from somebody who believes the Christian God told him to conquer, he believes that he is now to give the church what it needs. It needs legal authority to operate and legitimacy. So that's what he does. Now, I don't think we quite understand the depth of gratitude that the church felt toward Constantine. If you think a little bit about what's going on in Constantine's Rome, you have a generation of people who have been under the knife in the most serious way ever, and their leaders have been put into prison, tortured, some of them executed. The regular people have also sometimes been executed and tortured. And now they have an emperor who is coming to them and saying, here's money to build that church up that those guys burned down. Here's money to pay your bishop's salary. I would like to help you guys figure out the differences you guys have amongst yourselves. Can we get together as a group and I'll pay for your travels and we'll have this big council and we'll figure out who's right and who's wrong and we'll kind of give some rational thought to your beliefs, what you actually believe. And this actually happened in the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea happens in 325. Constantine the Great pays for bishops to travel from all over Roman Empire to this little place called Nicomedia. And he says, let's get together and let's figure out what you guys actually believe. Now, doesn't that sound like the sort of thing that the church should rejoice in? And they did. They felt, finally, we have relief. And I didn't give you the vocabulary, but the edict Constantine makes soon after his battle at the Milvian Bridge is the Edict of Milan, where he says Christianity is legal now. They're not an illegal religion. So Constantine brings these bishops from all over to Nicomedia. And they had a bunch of heresies in the church that they needed to figure out. For one, they had this guy named Arius, who was teaching that Jesus wasn't actually God. Jesus was kind of a lesser God. There was God the Father, and then there was the lesser God, Jesus, but he wasn't quite the same as God the Father. We obviously recognize that as not true. It's not what's in the Bible. But the church was divided over the issue, and they were so persecuted, they hadn't had time to get together in a peaceful way and figure this out. So Constantine brings them there. They're gathered in this opulent place. Constantine the Great is sitting there in his golden chair, watching proceedings, kind of letting the bishops do their thing. But you can tell how much he cares about this because he's invested time. He's there. He wants to know what's going on. And in addition to that, there's this bishop who comes in who lost an eye in the tortures under Diocletian. Constantine the Great sees him walk in. He gets up off his imperial throne. He walks down. He walks up to the man, and he kisses him on that eye that was not there anymore, as a sign of respect to this, you know, Christian man who faithfully survived his tortures without bowing to Rome's demands, and yet still managed to claim Jesus as his Lord and not deny him. That's a remarkable place to be for an emperor, right? The church thought Constantine was pretty good. Well, obviously, if you get the emperor to get your bishops all together, he's expecting you to get things right and to figure it out. He didn't pay for this just for nothing. So they had this big session. There are a lot of things things that we believe, actually, that come from the Council of Nicaea. I'm not going to get into all of them, but I do want to pick out this business of Arius, the heretic, because he was a heretic. The council decided he was. And Arius was there defending himself. Everybody else said, no, you're wrong. And they banished him. They said, you've got to leave the empire. Now, the church could never have done that before. It didn't have any kind of power. But now they had the emperor sitting up there. And the emperor said, yeah, whatever these guys decide happens. So he banished Arius too. Arius goes out of the empire. Now, interestingly, Arius goes to the people who live up in here. We're going to find out more about them in just a little bit. These are Germanic-speaking tribes, a whole bunch of different tribes. And a number of them convert to Christianity, but they convert to Arianism, to Arian Christianity. We'll find those, we'll learn more about them in just a little bit. But before we get there, let's now turn our gaze on Constantine. Is he actually good? Well, how about we just look at what he does and judge him by his works? The Bible says that's a good way to know somebody. So, Constantine the Great. Oh, let's see. He murdered his own son because he was afraid the guy was going to take power from him. And his son was in cahoots with Constantine's wife. Constantine's wife was back there kind of pulling strings to help get her son in position to be able to take Constantine's place. So Constantine had his wife killed too. So he murdered his wife and his son. He strong-arms the church into supporting him. So he lures them with the money he gives them, but then he's, in addition to getting them to decide internal differences, he also gets them to give him opinions about how society ought to run, and then he wants to tell them a little bit about how the church should run too. It's not a free lunch here. So is Constantine a good guy? I think most of us probably know that his effect on the church was devastating. What actually ended up happening is the church went from being an institution that had Jesus as its Lord to it went to being an institution that was answerable to Caesar. It went to being an institution that owed allegiance to Caesar. Well, Constantine didn't actually take the step to say everybody's got to go to church. Rather, what he did was, he said something to the effect of, if you're a Christian, I welcome you into my administration. So suddenly the incentives were there for people to want to become Christians because if you weren't a Christian, you were less welcome in higher government circles. So suddenly people started coming to church and saying, I want to be a Christian. How do I do that? And they got baptized, became Christians, and then went and got into government right afterwards. So the church became suddenly flooded with new converts. Well, this flood of new converts led to a church that suddenly did not look at all like the persecuted church of just a generation ago. It suddenly starts having all kinds of sin issues in the church. 80 years after Constantine the Great made it legal for the church to operate, 80 years later, another emperor comes along, Theodosius the Great, and he makes it illegal to be anything except a Christian. So the church went from being persecuted to persecuting other people in 80 years. A remarkably short time span. And that, I'm going to say, is Constantine's doing. It's really a result of his legacy. Well, let's now quickly go over some of the latter Roman history, Roman Empire history. We need to kind of finish it off to understand the full legacy of this Constantine guy. So this is the next thing that happens to Rome. See all of these names up here? The Franks, the Saxons, the Angles, the Jutes, the Vandals, the Goths, the Huns, the Ostrogoths. These are all those Germanic tribes up there. Some of them are Arian Christians. Now, I didn't say the Huns. Okay, the Huns are a different thing. They're from Central Asia. But these Germanic tribes, some of them have become Arian Christians. And as the empire aged past Constantine's time, so starting in about, it's hard to tell. The story is spread out over about 100 years, shall we say. But from, say, the 400s, we'll say that, the Roman Empire slowly collapsed in the West, not in the East, in the West. So a lot of these invaders had been trained in the Roman army because they had been brought into the Roman army to fight for them as auxiliaries. And they would live back in Germanic areas, and then they would come down and fight for the Romans for a period of maybe 20 years and then go back home. After a while, you get this kind of Romanized, or shall we say militarized society that grows up in here that's been trained by Rome, and they start deciding it's maybe time to come down and take some of Roman territory because they know how weak Rome is. There are some other reasons as well, but I'm out of time, so we won't go into those. Just for the record, they come barging into the empire, and the empire can't keep them out. Now, the Eastern Empire is relatively secure over here, but the Western Empire can't keep them out, and Rome is sacked in 410 for the first time in 800 years, and then it's sacked again in 455, and then finally the last Roman emperor is deposed in 476, I believe. His name was Romulus Augustulus, and he's deposed, and a new Germanic tribal warrior takes his place, and Odoacer and his Vandals, I think Odoacer is a Vandal, but I get some of these tribes mixed up with others, so we'll just say maybe. But Odoacer is the name of the guy, sets up his Germanic kingdom around Rome and rules Italy. Now, the Roman Empire in the West has collapsed. It is ruled by a bunch of different tribes that all speak variants of Germanic languages. Many of them are Arian Christians. But the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, is still the bishop of a church. There is still a church, a Roman Catholic church. Now, the Roman Catholic church is the same as the church in Constantinople, or over here in Jerusalem, or down in Alexandria. Those are all Roman Catholic church. When we say Catholic, we mean universal. They're all universal Catholic. It's during the age of the Catholic church. There is going to become a division where the Roman Catholics are going to start looking different from the Catholics here in Constantinople. We're not going to spend a huge amount of time on that. Just know that it's there. All right. So the Western Roman Empire is gone. Farewell. But in the East, that's not the case. But before we finish the story of the Western Roman Empire, I should note that these Arian Christians that come in and conquer the Romans that are Catholic Christians, those Arian Christians mostly begin to convert to Catholic Christianity. And after a couple of hundred years, this entire area is firmly Roman Catholic, as in it's Catholic It's a Catholic church that follows the Orthodox beliefs set out by the various church councils, and it considers Rome to be the chief diocese and the patriarch of Rome, or the Pope of Rome, to be the Bishop of Rome, to be its titular head. Now, Constantinople is still going strong as a Christian place, and its governor, the head of the church in Constantinople, is the patriarch. So the patriarch of Constantinople considers himself equal to the patriarch of Rome, and at this point, there's no good reason to say they weren't. Okay, I'm skipping chunks. I'm sorry. I would like to finish this section up in about 5 minutes, so we'll go through it pretty quickly. Let's see what we have. Okay, so this is just a little bit more about the fall of the Western Roman Empire, but it does show you how the Eastern Roman Empire is very, very solid still. It is not doing badly at all. And the Western Roman Empire is not really doing badly, it just has different political rulers. And its infrastructure is getting less attention than it used to. Okay, so let's look at the Byzantine Empire, because that's what this Eastern Roman Empire becomes. Somewhere in here it magically turns into the Byzantine Empire, and no historian can quite give you a good reason for calling it something else. So a lot of historians just call it the Eastern Roman Empire, but everybody knows it as the Byzantine Empire. It's going to keep going until just about 50 years before Christopher Columbus sails for the New World, so it's around for a while. Here in Constantinople, right here, this new, invigorated Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantine Empire, if you wish, continues the tradition of Roman rule. And it continues the tradition of Roman rule with a close emphasis on the church as an ally. This leads to a new term called Caesaropapism, which is basically the blending of church and state in a new, even solider way than what had already occurred in Rome. Here in Constantinople, the patriarch and the emperor work very closely together. There's very little difference, and society is seen as deeply Christian. Now, over here, you'll see the Persian Empire. This is an empire that has always been an enemy of the Roman Empire, and it is very much an enemy of the Byzantine Empire. So there's a lot of fighting on the border here, and it's going to continue for a long time, and it gets very serious. There are times when these Persians will invade deeply into Byzantine territory. There are times when they will band with the Bulgars here and attack Constantinople from two sides. And during some of those times, the patriarch of Constantinople is going to get out on the walls with his image of the Virgin Mary, and he's going to parade around the walls praying for her protection to keep the enemies of Christ at bay. Isn't that a remarkable change from where we started the story of the church, a small persecuted band of dedicated believers, to now a whole society that sees itself as deeply Christian, and when it's attacked, it sees the enemies as needing to be repelled and defeated through force or through Christ's miraculous protection. We'll pick up the story. I hope to kind of tie onto this later on tonight. Just know that what we've seen with this Constantine the Great is we've seen how he offered a new kind of power to the early church. And now we've seen what this new power did to the followers of Christ. For the first time, Christians have begun to think of the kingdom of God as a physical entity, one that needed to be managed with the power of coercion and violence. Meanwhile, on the desert fringes down here, of these two empires, a new religion is coming into being. The religion of Islam would transform both the Persian and the Byzantine empires in the next 100 years. I think that's where we'll end this section. So you can go ahead and take a 5 minute break, get up, move around. Thank you for being so prompt. I don't think our church at Center is nearly so prompt. We have to kind of chase them in, but you did very well with that. Couple things we should talk about. It's kind of home, homeroom teaching kinds of things, shall we say. First, I am not a preacher, so I like questions. Please raise your hand. Makes me feel at home. Interrupt me. That also makes me feel at home. Get your hand up and wave around. I'll stop and I'll listen to you. It helps me know what I need to teach. Okay. So if I'm missing something and you say I don't understand that, then I know how to, you know, change it up and give you what you need. So please do interact in that way. If you have questions about kind of things beyond the scope of what I'm talking about, I don't mind those as well. And if I think I don't have time to tackle it, I'll just say we'll need to deal with that maybe later. So I'm not worried if you ask questions that aren't quite on target. In fact, I'm actually kind of used to that. I teach fifth and sixth grades, and so the questions aren't nearly quite all on target, shall we say. Anyhow, so the next of the five stories we're looking at is Islam. So in the last session, we saw what happened when a religion was wooed into an unholy alliance with a political entity, the Roman Empire. In this section, we're going to look at the opposite situation. Islam is a religion that captured the political power and transformed it into its own image. So the situation between Islam and politics is not anything close to the situation in Christianity and politics. In Islam, the political situation is pretty similar to what the religious situation is. They don't really see much of a divide between the two. So it's not like you have rival institutions, although there is a little bit of that. That doesn't create a theological problem like it does in Christianity. I'm going to just quickly sketch kind of the rise of Islam, what's going on, how it gets started. I'll try to go in enough detail that you can follow. I know this is pretty probably history that you haven't encountered a lot, but there's a lot there that I can't really flesh out for you. So it's going to be a sketch of the history rather than a really detailed portrait. So Muhammad is born in this part of the world, or right here. Right in here. So if you know anything about this part of the world, you know it's dry. So this entire peninsula, it's called the Arabian Peninsula, and at least this section of it is quite dry. The coastal areas here are less dry, and they tend to be where most of the people live. Now, Muhammad is, he doesn't really show up much in the historical record until about, it's about age 40 that he really starts to have an impact, and I'll tell you why. But before that, he gets married to a wealthy widow. He's helping organize her caravans before that. This entire area is a trade route from the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean out here. The vessels come in, dock, and then the goods, some of them went overland, some went up here and went by other routes. So it's a trade route that he's living on, but it's a desert trade route, so it's oasis to oasis to oasis. Caravans of camels carry the goods. He's working for this lady, organizing her caravans, and then he gets married to her. When he was about 40 years old, he starts having visions. He claims that the angel Gabriel appears to him. The onlookers report that he would begin foaming at the mouth, his eyes would roll back, and then he would begin to say things. And they remembered what he said, and after his death, they wrote down the sayings of the prophet during these trances into a book called the Quran, and that is what the Islamic people to this day, Muslims, see as their holiest book. Now, there are other books. There's the Hadith, which is a collection of sayings that the prophet made to various people, but not in this trance-like state. So the Hadith are seen as less authoritative than the Quran. The Quran is a little bit difficult to read because it's not really a narrative of any sort. It's a kind of a jumble of sayings. And so it actually can be quite difficult for a Westerner used to a narrative to kind of piece it together. These visions he had, he claimed they scared him. He didn't know quite what was happening. But eventually some of his closest friends said, no, these are from God. Now, to understand what they meant by God, you first have to understand the situation in the Arabian Peninsula here. So the people in Arabia are nomads. And like tribal nomads in most of the world, they have a bunch of different gods they worship. They worship spirits. They were animistic. And here in Mecca, I think it's this one here. That's not right. It's this, I think. In that area, in Mecca, yes?
If you turn that light off, that is really...
This light?
Yes.
Ah, okay, sure. No problem. Oh, that's messy. Thank you for noting that. I appreciate that. In this area, there's a particular black stone that was venerated, and there was an area where they would set up idols to their different gods. I think it was over 300 of them, and the tribes would come from around the Arabian Peninsula and worship these 300-plus gods there. So it's a pagan society, and now Muhammad is starting to have these dreams or these visions or these utterances, and the utterances kind of coalesce into one thing. There is only one God, a very starkly one God being, and so these pagan idol worshipers are doing the wrong thing. So he is not seen as a particularly popular guy. The people in Mecca do not like him, and they chase him off. So he has to run from Mecca to the neighboring town of Medina. And this happens in 622 of our calendar. Muslims will call that year zero or year one. I don't remember which. I think it's year zero. It's the beginning of their calendar when he leaves Mecca and goes to Medina. It's called the Hijra. And when Muslims go on the Hajj or a pilgrimage to Mecca, what they're doing is remembering Muhammad's flight from Mecca. So he leaves Mecca, goes to Medina, and in Medina he finds a sort of a different situation. There are Jews and Christians and pagans all living in proximity, and his utterances continue, and some of them begin to be rather violent and to command him to do rather terrible things to other people. And as his popularity grows there, he starts to get some believers to follow him. And the utterances also change a little bit. One thing that shows up is a more starkly one God. Now, the Christians he's interacting with in Medina are heretical Christians. They have been exiled from the Roman Empire. Well, not exiled. They have been exiled. The process started before, I think, Constantine the Great, but it has gotten worse. They live there, and they are essentially claiming that God is one and that Jesus is not quite the same as God. So they're Christians, but they have some of the similar Arian heresy going on that the Germanic tribes did. And so Muhammad is interacting with these people, and his utterances start to convey a more starkly one kind of God. In addition to that, he starts to have utterances that organize society, talking about marriage, talking about the proper way to split up booty when you conquer other caravans, a whole bunch of things like that. Well, eventually, his men begin to raid the caravans that come past that are from Mecca. So the caravans of Mecca have to kind of go out around a little bit to get past him. And his guys are getting pretty good at raiding those caravans. And eventually, it gets to the point where in 630, he leads his men from Medina and he conquers Mecca. He is now the ruler of Mecca and Medina. And he is the religious authority in both places. There are still Christians and Jews in both of those places, but they're not a huge population. So now he controls much of this part of Arabia. So this is seen as the most fertile part of Arabia, and he's fairly successful. He feels like he's done it, kind of. Well, he's going to die in 632, and that's going to set up a bit of a problem because nobody has really planned for his death. What do you do when the religious leader dies? Well, I need to finish the story I started earlier of these, that is really hard to see that. Okay, well, we're just going to go with it. So this is, let's try again. So roughly, the Persian Empire occupies this area right here. It is a huge enemy of the Byzantine Empire, which something like this, maybe a little bit more up into here. They're fighting, and they're fighting in a serious war. It gets so serious that neither side is sure if either one is going to survive. And eventually, the emperor of Constantinople does this little trick maneuver where he leaves Constantinople, comes out here, gets his army out here, and while the Persian army is plundering in here and potentially heading toward Constantinople, he comes out and he conquers the Persian capital. He now has the Persian capital city under his control. The leaders of the Persian society are devastated, and they eventually surrender the Persian leader, and that brings an end to the war. So the emperor's name that did this was Heraclius, and by capturing the Persian capital, he has kind of done the knockout blow. Now, both of these empires up here, this empire and this one, are exhausted. They've been fighting for decades. And finally, the East has won. The Eastern Roman Empire is victorious. Well, down here, Muhammad is building his little empire. It's pretty tiny, and it's made of nomads, and nobody cares about the nomads. They're out in the desert. Who knows that they're even there? They don't really know much about them, and they don't care about them. There's just not very many of them. They should have cared, according to the people who care about politics. This is an important omission. So what's going to happen is Muhammad dying starts a process in which his religious group gets together and figures out who's going to be his successor. And they have a special name for the successors of the prophet. They call them caliph. So there's going to be four caliphs that happen in pretty quick succession that are considered by Sunni Muslims to be the rightly guided ones. They're called the Rashidun Caliphate. And these four guys are seen as being better than all the others that come after them. But the Shia are going to see only one of those as actually legitimate. And I'll get more to that later if I have time. So the first caliph, his name is Umar. Abu Bakr. He only rules for 2 years. And if you'll note this color right here, that is the territory added by the first four caliphs, the Rashidun caliphs. So you can see that in this time from 632 to 661, a very short period of time, the empire of, or the area ruled by Islam goes from this small section of, or half of the Arabian Peninsula, to including all of this. Huge sections of those other two empires. So what happens is Abu Bakr starts by consolidating control over the Arabian Peninsula. He dies 2 days or 2 years later. And then Umar takes over. And Umar leads his army north. And one of his captains fights the Byzantine general Heraclius, the emperor who had knocked out the Persians. They fight him 10 years after his great victory over the Persians. They meet him in this battle of Yarmouk. And I don't think Umar was actually at the battle. I think his general was leading it. I can't remember that detail for sure. But what happens is Heraclius is badly beaten by these desert nomads, riding these quick little horses, shooting lots of arrows, and just moving so rapidly, it just kind of bewildered his force. He was kind of overwhelmed before he knew what happened. So with that battle, suddenly the Byzantine Empire went from controlling Egypt to basically just controlling a little section here. They lose this entire section of Egypt and the Levant. All of that gets taken by the Arabs under Umar. Egypt was a huge loss. It's the most expensive. It's the richest part of the empire as far as grain production is concerned. It's where Constantinople's bread comes from. If you lose your bread, you're kind of going to have to reorganize your trade routes, and so that's exactly what had to happen. The Battle of Yarmouk was a huge wake-up call to the Byzantine Empire. But worse things were in store for the former Persian Empire. Very quickly, Umar's forces tear into Persian territory, and there's really nothing to stop them. They just basically annex the whole thing in a very short period of time, and suddenly all of Persia is under Muslim control, and half of the Byzantine Empire is under their control, and it's only, 661. That's just a part of a century since Muhammad lived. It's an incredibly fast turnabout. Now, remember Heraclius had been connected to the patriarch? Remember the patriarch and Heraclius had been working together? In fact, while Heraclius is out here conquering the Persian Empire, the patriarch back in Constantinople, he's getting the devoted faithful to be praying for their hero emperor out there fighting the evil, Zoroastrians, which is what the Persians were. Well, what do you do when that hero emperor loses to a new religion? What do you do? How do you as a Christian society think about that? Well, what they did is they did some deep soul searching and said, we've been wicked. God is judging us. We've got to change. And it kind of leads to some of the iconoclast controversies. I'm not going to get into that. But basically, Christian society saw the Muslims as obviously enemies who are attacking them, and they must defeat them. And if they are being defeated, God must not be on their side anymore. Well, it gets worse for the Byzantines. After Uthman comes along. He's another one of the Rashidun caliphs. He standardizes the written form of the Quran. He collects all the Quranic, the different versions. He writes down the ones that he thinks are authentic, and gets rid of the others, burns the others. And so that's when the Quran is kind of established in his period. But he keeps on going with the conquest. He's instrumental in conquering a big chunk of the North African coastline. He starts to build a navy. Now, this should be very concerning to Constantinople. Constantinople is the Mediterranean's greatest naval power, and they must control the sea lanes if they are to survive as an empire. And with the Islamic caliphate under Uthman building a navy, it's time to start getting concerned. Well, finally, Uthman dies. He dies in 656. So 656, Uthman dies. And now it's time for the only connection, the only blood connection to Muhammad to become a caliph. So this guy's name is Ali, and his claim to Muhammad is that he is married to Muhammad's daughter. He's the son-in-law of Muhammad. All the other guys were unconnected by blood to Muhammad. They were just seen as important members of the Islamic community. So Ali comes along. He is voted as the caliph. He is based out here in what we now call Iran. And he has a problem. The problem is, when he takes power, there's another governor over here in Syria, around Baghdad. His name is Muawiyah. And Muawiyah is a powerful figure. And Muawiyah decides that he does not agree with Ali being the caliph. And so Ali and Muawiyah begin a civil war, which ends after a while. But toward the end of it, Ali ends up dying right close to the end. He's not killed in battle necessarily, but he dies. And everybody's wondering what's next. Well, the people over here in Iran say, well, it's obvious what needs to happen next. Ali's son, Hussein, must be the next caliph. Muawiyah over here in Syria says, remember, I've been fighting him for a long time. It's time for me now to be the caliph. So there's another war, and this time Ali's son, Hussein, is killed in battle. And Muawiyah becomes the caliph. Now, This is the moment where Sunni and Shia split in Islam. So Sunni Islam, which makes up the vast majority of Islamic people, Sunni Islam holds that the caliphs do not necessarily need to follow a certain bloodline. They kind of, a caliph can be any successor of the prophet who is called by the ummah, as they call it, the body of Islam, to be the caliph. But Shia say, no, the true caliphs are only, the true successors are only the people in Muhammad's bloodline. So it's Muhammad, and then we skip all the other rightly guided ones, and we go to Ali, and then after Ali, it's Hussein, and so on. But the caliphal line kind of disappears for a while in there, and they don't know quite who's the next caliph, and they think there's some coming. There's some real apocalyptic versions of Shia, and they tend to be based around Iran or groups affiliated with Iran. So that's explains a very important divide in Islam, and it happens here at the very beginning, or near the very beginning, in the 600s. All right, we must continue, so we will. Let's see here. So, things get very scary for Constantinople up here. They've already lost the richest part of their empire to these religiously different people. They're not quite sure at this point, are these guys actually a different religion, or are they just weird Christians? Because Islam does not deny Jesus' existence. They said Jesus existed. The difference for Islam is they say Jesus cannot be God, because for Islam, God is starkly one. There is no other thing. This idea of a trinity is very heretical to Islam. And so by denying Jesus' divinity, they clearly place themselves at odds with what the Bible teaches. Okay, so they don't agree with the Bible. So the Christians in Constantinople weren't sure, are these actually a different religious group, or are they kind of like Arius and those other groups? Not quite sure at first, but that quickly hardened into very certain. Constantinople starts trying to figure out how can it hang on to its territory, because it simply can't handle these Arab tribesmen. The armies of Islam are simply too powerful for them on land. They're able to kind of hold the barrier here. This is a fairly mountainous area, and they're able to pretty much build forts along there and hold them out for a while, but they dealt with raids every summer in the interior part of Anatolia. But then things got really scary when the Arabs got ships. So the Muslim navy leaves from its port here in Egypt, and it sails up to Constantinople. Meanwhile, a powerful army marches overland. So let's just note, we're zooming way in. Let me back up a bit. We're going to look at this little section right here. That's our next slide. So our next slide is zoomed way in. You can see up here is the Black Sea. There's a little trickle of water through here. It's called the Bosphorus. It's actually big enough that you can see easily across it, but it's a huge section of water. It just looks small here. There's another narrow place down here called the Dardanelles. This inland sea is generally seen as sort of a Byzantine lake. They control it. But when the Arabs show up, they sail their ships right up into here. Their army is coming up into here. And now our next slide is going to zoom in on the city of Constantinople, because this becomes probably the most frightening moment for Christianity in its war with Islam early on. So that's zoomed way in now. Now this is the city of Constantinople, and this should help explain why it's such a powerful city. It is a fantastically defensible position. So this little body of water is called the Golden Horn, and it can be protected by a chain strung across here. So ships cannot sail through there easily. There are stories of Viking ships sailing over that chain, but what happens is often they would get partway over and then their ship would break as it high-centered on that chain. So it's very hard to sail. You can't sail a big fleet in there. That chain has to be dismantled if you want to get in there. So the Byzantine Navy had this protected harbor that nobody was going to tackle them in. And then out here, you had huge walls. These are giant walls. They're still there. Some of them are still there today. I've seen some of them. When you look up at them and think about putting a ladder up against them, you realize what a silly idea that is. You don't want to do that. You try to do that, and bad things will happen to you, especially if there's anybody up on top. So these are huge walls. Now, the the sea walls are less imposing, but they're still there. There's a wall around that. They're smaller. But the thing is, if you're going to attack the sea walls, you have to come with a navy. And the current in the Bosphorus flows that direction. So if you are down here trying to attack the walls, the current can easily bring some of these Byzantine naval ships out to attack you, and you can't do much about it. Well, the Arabs decided this was their moment. So I think this is taking place in, there are two sieges. The one that was most important is 717 AD. Now, this is not under any of the rightly guided caliphs. This is after their period. It's under the successors to Muawiyah, who were called the Umayyad dynasty of caliphs. So they're attacking Constantinople in 717. They've got this huge fleet. They've got a large land army. And they're going to try to hit Constantinople from the water, and they're going to try to hit it from land. The problem is, to get to it from land, they've got to control this, the Bosphorus here. So they're going to have to bring their fleet up here and keep the Byzantine navy in there. Because if that navy comes out, they can't get their men across the Bosphorus. So they've got them on the wrong side. They need to control that strait, and that becomes the problem. As they sail their ships up here, the Byzantines, knowing the currents and the winds, gather their army, they drop the chain, or their navy, they drop the chain, and they sail their ships out. And they hit the Arabs with this massive attack involving a new kind of weapon. Now, the weapon is more a weapon system. This is called Greek fire. And Greek fire was a blend of kind of a crude oil and various other flammable things. Don't know exactly the mix. We know roughly what's in it, but not the exact mix. Supposedly it was some great state secret, although everybody kind of knew what's in it, and it could have been probably replicated by other groups. But what was intriguing about this is how it was deployed. So you'll see kind of this bronze cannon-like thing down in the belly of the ship. There would have been a, I'm sorry. Down in the belly of the ship, there would have been kind of a bladder, probably made of some sort of skins, and connected by a long hose to this bronze nozzle, and they would pump this bladder and squirt out the oily, flammable liquid, and then they would ignite it. As it left the nozzle here, it would be lit. And so you're basically launching this burning, splattery napalm onto the ships facing you. So this was frightening stuff because it burned even on water. So even the surface of the Bosphorus kind of turned into an inferno. And the Byzantine ships just completely routed the Arab fleet. The Arabs did not know how to handle this. Later on, they would develop mechanisms. They'd hang green hides in the rigging and on the sides, or they'd have like loads of sand so they could smother the fire with sand. But this first demonstration was just completely overwhelming. And they completely chased off the Arab fleet. And suddenly, the Byzantine Empire suddenly feels like, oh, maybe we're not so bad after all. Maybe God has just protected us from these Arabs, from these Muslims. So you can see the tensions between Islam and Christianity, they go back to the very beginning of Islam. Now, that's not the only place that tensions existed. So by the 750s, so now note that this is just a little bit over 100 years after Muhammad's death in 732. It's 100 and some change. In the 750s, by then, they had conquered this gigantic section of the Middle East and Europe. It's a huge empire. This thing is, well, in some ways, it's almost bigger than Rome. It's all united under this Islamic religion that is both a religion and a political ideology. Now, it has tried, Islam, in its turn, has tried to attack Constantinople, or it has attacked it, and has not succeeded in conquering it. The other place Islam has been stopped is up here at a place in France called Tours. And in Tours, an Islamic force kind of raiding as far as it can from Spain up here into Frankish territory, territory controlled by a Germanic tribe called the Franks, meets a kind of a group of Franks led by the palace, mayor of the palace. His name is Charles, and Charles at this battle proves to be a very capable war leader and quite a ferocious fighter. And because of his ability to swing his great battle axe, or else because of his skill at stopping the Arabs, I'm not quite sure which, there's conflicting accounts, he gets a nickname. He's called Charles Martel, which in Frankish, in the French language, or the Frankish language, means Charles the Hammer. So he's quite a vigorous leader. So the situation now, at this point, between Christianity and Islam, is that it has become largely a political contest. The tensions are built around military and its ability to control territory. And Christianity has stopped the Islamic advance there and has stopped it over here. So now Islam has kind of been cornered out of Europe. So by the middle of the 700s, Islam has shown that it's the most vigorous monotheistic religion. Its culture and its language is going to transform great swaths of Africa, Asia, and Europe. Its expansive tendencies would soon turn inward, and a less hostile and more trade-based society would replace the relentless conquests of that first century. However, new peoples and new manifestations of old threats would eventually confront the caliphs of the Islamic Golden Age. And we're going to look at that tomorrow when we look at the Crusades. And that's going to be our next time frame. Now, that's going to be jumping forward a long ways. I couldn't figure out any way to bridge that. So we'll do our best to get you up to speed on the history that goes on. But what I want you to note here, when we think about Islam and Christianity and the tensions that exist there, note the cycles that have happened so far. Christian religion becomes a state religion. It begins to defend territory. And then it encounters this new religion of Islam and immediately sees it as a threat and attacks it and loses. And then in turn feels this deep kind of inner turmoil about what do we do about this loss of territory? How do we see ourselves now? How do we see God? What does that do to our understanding of what it means to be saved? And are we sinning? So now, suddenly, the church's inner life is connected very deeply to the political and the military situation it finds itself in. Very, very different from the Christians that we would recognize as being a very different kind of church in the pre-Constantine moment. Do you have any questions? Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. I really should have spent a bit more time in outlining and laying out kind of their beliefs. Islamic people see themselves as descended from Ishmael. The story they tell about Abraham sacrificing a son is that he was sacrificing Ishmael, not Jacob. So by doing that, it sets up Ishmael's descendants as kind of the right people, the promised people. The way they interact, and that's a good question because it reminds us of some other things, the way they interact with both the Old Testament and the New Testament, is they say both of these books were given to humans by God, but humans have corrupted them. And so Muhammad brings this final uncorrupted version. And because of that, they actually think it's good and important to read the books of the people of the book, as they call them, either Christians or Jews, they should read those books. Which means that when you interact with a Muslim, it is okay to offer a New Testament to them and say, would you like to read the Injil? They will, if they are educated well in their religion, they will recognize that as an okay thing to do. Yes?
I think my question is related to maybe the facts. You made a little bit of mention about Muhammad getting a vision from Gabriel.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that in mind, it seems like looking at a lot of the writings of Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
there seems to be a template on it that reflects a lot of what we see in the Bible.
Yes.
And
okay, so just note.
First off, did it come by revelation from God?
Okay,
that,
yeah.
Or did it come?
So just note that if I were talking to a Muslim person, I would be, I would not be quick to try to find some way to confront them. I would try to find a way to bridge from what they believe to the Bible, which there are many bridges you can build from that. However, at the end of the day, it's pretty obvious that if this came from God the Father, then he's directly contradicting what he wrote in the New Testament.
Right.
So I don't think there's any way you can make that argument.
No, I hope that option was given to me.
Of course. Yes. Where did they come from?
Yeah.
So I think if you remember back here, I talked about Medina having a pretty significant population of Christians, kind of a heretical branch of Christians. I can't remember the exact name of them. They have a term for them. But it also had a population of Jews. Both of these groups were involved in trade. And that's Muhammad's vocation. I think that's where he interacted with Christianity most significantly, and I think that's where a lot of the Christian-Jewish language starts to seep into his revelations. That's my impression. Excellent questions. Are there some others? Okay. Well, I think we should close with prayer. Let's pray.